This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saturday was the 50th anniversary of the Japanese surrender in World War II. My guest Eric Lomax has an extraordinary story of how he reconciled with the man who was his worst enemy during the war. Lomax is a British veteran who was taken prisoner of war by the Japanese in 1942. He and several of his fellow POWs scavenged materials to build a makeshift radio receiver, which they used to monitor news of the war. The guards discovered the receiver, and the men who built it were punished with brutal beatings. Two men were beaten to death. Lomax survived, though most of his limbs were broken. Before he had time to heal, his Japanese captors, believing Lomax was a spy, interrogated and tortured him. The sound of the interrogator's voice haunted Lomax decades after the war ended, but a couple of years ago he met his tormentor and finally forgave him. Lomax explains in his new memoir, The Railway Man. I asked him what he remembers about the men who presided over his torture.
There were always two men. One was an NCO, a sergeant of the Kempeitai, that is the Japanese military police, and he changed from time to time. I think the Japanese sent for reinforcements when they found they weren't getting results. The second man, a small man, who was there the whole time, possibly for as long a period as 10 days. And he was an interpreter, basically a civilian rather than a soldier, but nevertheless under military discipline. And his job was to carry out the interrogation. He was, of course, an interpreter. He was the only person in that particular group of Japanese who could speak English. So he had to continue soldiering on for a period of somewhere about a week. There was no replacement for him, no reinforcements. So I saw a great deal of him for a period of a week or 10 days.
This is the man who you've since met and forgiven. Tell me a little bit about what he became in your mind, what he started to symbolize to you.
Well, every POW saw hundreds, if not thousands, of Japanese troops at one time or another. And generally speaking, we never saw any one for any particular length of time, with the exception of my interpreter, whom I was very close to indeed for a whole week. So over a period of time, and certainly after the war, the entire Japanese army was practically focused to me through this one particular face, this one particular voice. And, of course, I didn't know his name. I could only visualize him from his appearance and from his voice. It was unusual for any POW to become so close, in the worst sense of the term, with any particular Japanese.
What kind of questions would he ask you, and what kind of threats did he make?
Well, the questions were very wide-ranging, very varied, but they were really aimed at trying to establish that the POWs in my little group were in contact with the Siamese civilians and that we were trying to organise some sort of sabotage or uprising or general insurrection. We, of course, were not, in fact, in contact with them, but this was a very difficult matter to establish. The Japanese wanted to identify a spy, and they tried very hard indeed to establish that it was myself.
So what were the threats that he would give you?
Well, by that time we had all had some very severe beatings. My arms were in splints throughout the whole of the interviews from end to end. And the threats were really directed towards further beatings. And then eventually I was informed that I was going to be killed in any case. So perhaps it would make it easier for myself if I started to talk. In fact, that didn't make any difference in the long run, because if any group of interrogators have a victim with information which they want, the last thing they're going to do is to kill him, because they would lose their source of information.
So in between his interrogation and his threats, you were tortured, you were beaten. There was a water torture also, in which they basically poured water down your nose and down your throat, and you came very close to drowning, and then they'd revive you, bring you back to life for more interrogation and more torture.
Yes, that's correct. That's exactly as it happened. Much of my information about this, strangely enough, comes from a little book written by the interpreter himself, because I think I must have been semi-conscious for part of the time and totally unconscious for part of the time, because the interpreter, whose name I didn't know at that time, has described the whole event in terms which I can't altogether recognize.
Did you ever try to reach him as a fellow human being and you know, just beg him to stop?
I don't think so. I think the nearest I got to that was a little bit of a sidetracking attempt when I decided to ask him about the Japanese educational system. This was intended to waste time and generally deflect their concentration on myself. And he rose to the occasion and started to tell me about the Japanese educational system. And we had quite a bit of a conversation about this. But I could see on his right-hand side the military police NCO getting very restless and restive. And eventually he started to lay into the interpreter, obviously asking what we were doing, what we were talking about, and so on. And then he told the interpreter that he was supposed to be asking the questions, not me.
Was there ever a moment during the interrogations when you felt that your interrogator was trying to talk to you like a human being?
Very occasionally, yes. But not until we eventually parted company. On the very last day, when my colleagues and I were being put into a Japanese army truck, and of course we had no idea where we were going, I was the last to get on the truck because I had to be assisted. And the interpreter turned to me and said, "Keep your chin up."
Now, I'm going to jump ahead several decades to the late 1980s, when you found out who your anonymous interpreter interrogator was. How did you find out his identity?
I tried for about 5 years by making inquiries, and then eventually one day, when I was in the middle of my inquiries, I was given a photocopy of a cutting from the Japan Times, dated the 15th of August, 1989. And the cutting showed the photograph of a Japanese with quite a lot of accompanying text. And of course it was in English. I recognized the photograph and I began to read the text. And within a matter of minutes, I'd come to the conclusion that this was a modern photograph of the young man who had been my interrogator. And the text was exceptionally interesting. It gave his name. It quoted his name as Nagase Takashi. I had not heard that name up to that point. And it also explained how the man concerned had suffered terribly, physically and psychologically, during the 40-odd years since the end of the war, how he had been terribly upset by the being involved in the ill treatment and torture of a British Royal Signals officer. And the whole thing quite obviously referred to myself. I just couldn't believe this coincidence. It took quite a little while before it really sunk in that after several years' work, I'd finally identified the man that I was pursuing.
Why were you pursuing him? Why did you want to find him in the first place?
Very hard to explain. It's just something that drove me on. I didn't do much about it for the first 40 years after the end of the war. I was busy, like everybody else, earning a living. But when I retired early in the 1980s, I began to pursue him. I had ideas about doing him some harm, and this idea persisted for quite a long time. But eventually, I began to moderate that idea and toned it all down. But it's very hard to explain why I wanted to pursue him, just something that drove me on to try to identify the man who had been such a central feature of my life and ill treatment as a POW.
But your initial motivation was revenge.
Yes. Yes, absolutely right.
So when you read this article from a Japanese paper that said that he was remorseful, did you buy this? Did you believe it?
I took it at face value, but I decided to make a lot of further inquiries. And in fact, I spent well over a year making further inquiries. I got press cuttings. I got magazine articles about the man. I wrote to the British Embassy in Tokyo for further information. Everybody told me the same story, that he appeared to be apologetic, that he seemed to be trying to put things right, that he was opposing Japanese militarism, and that in general terms he was trying to get on with various charitable and other good works, partly in Japan and partly in Thailand.
And what made you decide to actually try to contact him and meet him?
Well, it seemed to be the logical next step, that all the inquiries I made brought satisfactory results. So my wife, Patty, decided to write to him with my full support. So she sent off a letter, and I think the letter must have given Mr. Nagase the most terrible fright, because we discovered afterwards that he had thought I had been dead for many, many years, and to get a letter from the dead must give anyone a little bit of a fright. However, he responded very quickly indeed, and wrote the most beautiful letter, full of apologies, full of expressions of remorse, and then we continued the correspondence, and the correspondence continued, not exactly overnight, but with gaps, for a period of well over a year. And we discussed the possibility of having a meeting. And I could see no reason for not having a meeting, so we pressed on, and we eventually met, as is quoted in the book, we eventually met early in 1993 in Thailand.
My guest is Eric Lomax. His new memoir is called The Railway Man. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Eric Lomax. His new memoir, The Railway Man, is about the years he was held prisoner of war by the Japanese. He recently met and forgave his interrogator. I'd like to hear your description of the moment that you met the interpreter who interrogated you.
Well, it was certainly quite remarkable. There has never been another occasion like it in my life, as one can well imagine. We arranged to meet at 10 o'clock on a certain spot, a terrace, not very far from the end of the River Kwai Bridge at Kanchanaburi. I got there first. I saw this small figure approaching, and I recognised him. I'd forgotten just how small he was. I addressed him in Japanese. I just said, "Good morning, how are you?" And he replied in English, expressing his sorrow for what had happened. We shook hands, and we went to sit on a nearby seat in the shade. And we talked for perhaps 45 minutes or even an hour. And we talked almost as if we were old friends meeting for the first time after many years' interval. It was really quite remarkable. There was no animosity, no aggression, no difficulty. We even talked about his army pension, and we arranged later on that day to go on a tour around Kanchanaburi to visit some of the important, some of the places which were important during the war.
Did he tell you what it was like to be in his shoes with the assignment of interrogating you?
Yes, he explained how unhappy he had been, how he was compelled to follow his orders, what a terrible situation he and his family would have been in if he had disobeyed. And he even told me at one point that he was reprimanded by his superiors in the military police for not being fierce enough with me.
Over 45 years had elapsed between the time that he interrogated you and the time that you met him. Again, were there questions you had stored up over the years? You know, if I ever get to meet him, this is what I would ask.
Yes, you're quite right. There were quite a number of things that I had stored up, and I never really got answers to them, I think quite genuinely, because Mr. Nagase was not in a position to answer them. I wanted to know who had given the orders for the search which led to the discovery of the radios. I wanted to know why they suspected we had a radio at all. And I wanted to know about the fate of the military police NCOs who had interrogated me sitting beside Mr. Nagase. and I couldn't get answers to any of these questions. I think Mr. Negasi quite genuinely didn't know. But one curious side issue came to the surface, and that was that the Japanese regarded me as a bit of a prize catch. And they brought Mr. Negasi specially from Saigon in Indochina to Kanchanaburi in Thailand in order to interrogate me, because they didn't think they had anybody available locally who was a sufficiently good interpreter. And another thing I discovered was that I was apparently the only POW questioned by Mr. Negasi. He was transferred to other duties immediately after he had finished with me. This was quite important because it meant that for the rest of his life, the ill effects of that ill treatment and that torture could be attributable to his confrontation with myself.
Right, when he thought about the torture, you were the victim. You were the only victim that he was responsible for. So you were as important in his mind as he was in yours, in a way.
Absolutely, yes, this is perfectly true.
Now, why did the Japanese think of you as such a prize catch?
Well, I was a lieutenant in the Royal Signals. We were very highly trained in communication, in radio and other forms of communication. The Japanese were rather backward at that particular time. We were well ahead of them technically. And I think they attributed a little bit too much to a Royal Signals officer. They seemed to think that we could make transmitters out of banana skins and this sort of thing, which, of course, we could not do. So they thought that I would almost certainly have organized any difficulty or general communication matters for miles around. In actual fact, they attributed a little bit too much to me.
Did you get a sense of what transformed him?
Yes, he explained how he was a devout Buddhist and he required forgiveness, not only for purposes of this life, but for purposes of the future life. He explained how he had understood that I had died many, many years before and that this upset his long-term prospects, and certainly his prospects in the future world. So he was particularly glad that I had survived, particularly glad that we were having meetings and having conversations, and quite obviously he wanted my forgiveness. And there now developed a little bit of a cultural problem, because he understood that my appearance at Kanchanaburi in our meeting and our discussion constituted forgiveness. And he told me that this was the happiest day of his life. These were his exact words. In fact, I had not forgiven him at that point, and I hadn't given him any indication that I had. I carried forward the idea that I might forgive him, but I wanted to have further conversations, further discussions with him. After all, we'd planned to spend somewhere about a further 3 weeks together, and I certainly had not forgiven him at that first point. But Mr. Negasi thought I had forgiven him, so we had to sort that out.
When did you forgive him?
About 3 weeks later, shortly before we were due to leave Tokyo. Mr. and Mrs. Negasi and my wife and I were in next-door bedrooms in a hotel in Tokyo, and I decided at that point, after 3 weeks of further conversation and contact with Negasi, I decided that I could in fact forgive him. So I wrote him out a carefully worded letter of forgiveness, which I thought would meet his Buddhist requirements, quite apart from his day-to-day requirements, and I arranged to have a little private meeting with him one morning in his bedroom, gave him this letter, went over it word by word to make sure that he understood every word of it, and he was absolutely delighted. And I have never had the slightest reason to doubt his honesty or his integrity or his authenticity. I think he is absolutely genuine, and I stand by that forgiveness that I gave him.
What did you say in the letter?
Well, I'd have to quote from memory. It is, in fact, in the book, but I explained that he was taking too much of the entire guilt of the Japanese nation on his own shoulders, that he was quite right to oppose militarism, that I personally was quite satisfied with his post-war life, his post-war career, that he had demonstrated his regret at what happened in 1943, that I understood he was acting under orders, and I was quite happy to give him forgiveness.
How has offering forgiveness to your interrogator changed you and changed your dreams even?
Well, I think one almost has to ask other people that, but so far as I can answer the question, it lifts a burden, it lightens one's load. And almost going off at a slight tangent, I can see no point in perpetuating hatefulness or bitterness, because it doesn't do any harm to the person that one is hating. It just pulls down the person who is being hateful and bitter. But it's very hard to generalize about this. It's so much a personal matter.
Do you communicate with Mr. Negassi anymore?
Yes, we write and we telephone. We hope to meet again. We have no immediate plans for meeting. I suppose we'll have to do it fairly quickly. He's slightly older than I am. We're both old enough. So I think we'll probably have to arrange that, but we have no immediate plans. But yes, I would like to see him again, very much indeed.
Did meeting Mr. Negassi give you more hope about the human condition?
Yes, but only in a very, very small way.
Right, a select few.
Yes. After all, there are only two of us, as distinct from millions of other people. But yes, it does suggest that it is possible for two people with goodwill to become reconciled. And I would certainly take pleasure in meeting Mr. Negassi again.
I thank you so much for sharing some of your story with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Eric Lomax, his new memoir is called The Railway Man. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.